To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious, and hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, and I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Joyce.
And today we have Keffi Curley. Hello, Keffi.
Hello.
So, Keffi, it's been a while since you've been on the show. You want to let folks know what you've been doing for the past, like, 2+ years?
Sleeping.
Sleeping?
Yes.
Sleeping.
Okay. Is that what you're getting a PhD in?
I'm getting a PhD in sleeping in my office because no one actually checks on me. No one knows where my office is or goes into it. So that's pretty good. Okay, technically my degree is going to say genetics, though. So genetics. I've been spending the past 2.5 years working on a PhD in genetics.
On a PhD in genetics and working on Glittership, which is an LGBTQ+, I think is what it says on the website.
Yeah, I've started just saying queer. It's a queer science fiction fantasy.
Queer science fiction fantasy magazine podcast.
Yes.
Which I think the last time we talked to you, you were just about to start it. But now you've been at it for 3 years. So I guess the question is, what has that been like to be working on something so specific for so long?
It's been interesting. I've learned things. Like, I still have bookmarks that I hand out because, you know, when you buy 1,000 or so bookmarks, you're going to just keep handing them out until you run out, no matter what, even if no one wants them. But on the back of the bookmarks, it says that we update 4 times a month, and that is filthy lie, which I discovered shortly after I started, that was not a pace I was able to keep up with, even with guest readers. So mostly the past 3 years have been making horrible mistakes and then learning from them.
Interesting, including buying too many bookmarks.
And lying
to your customers.
Yes, basically all of that.
Okay. But what about some of the positive sides of running a magazine for 3 years?
Yeah, so you know, besides the fact that I'm a sarcastic and terrible person, the things that have been fun about Glittership are that I have edited previously. So I edited for Shimmer magazine for about 5 years.
Yep.
And one of the things that's been surprising about Glittership is that the overall quality of submissions tends to be a lot higher, and I think that's because fewer people know about Glittership to submit to me. And so I don't get the people who are just sending out stories wherever to try and get a publication credit. Most of the people who are sending things to Glittership are at least somewhat familiar with the magazine, have either read it or are familiar with the authors I previously published. So I usually get to read a lot of good stuff, which makes it hard because sometimes that makes it really hard to make decisions. And most of my editorial decisions on what I'm purchasing come down to personal taste, which is good and bad. The other thing that's nice is just the number of authors that I'm able to publish. I've been able to publish authors who have had a very long and storied career already. I have had, like, reprints from people like Rick Bowes or Rachel Swirsky, and that's really fun. And also part of why I do reprints, because Rachel Swirsky does not write enough short stories and would not send me an original. even if I asked really nice, because she's got so many other people who want her stuff. But I also am able to publish, like, newer writers. I published one author who... It was another reprint, but it was a reprint from her high school lit mag in, I think, Singapore, because she was going to a Singapore high school. And so it's great to be able to also find those newer writers who I'd never heard of before. And because I can do whatever I want as the editor, I can make space for those newer voices when they send me really fun stuff. Yeah, her story was a... It was really fun because it was... I believe the title is The Sun and the Stars Revolve Around Her. I'm really bad at remembering things. But the story is about two women who are dating, And unbeknownst to either one of them, their secret identities are a superhero and a supervillain who are in constant battles.
Oh.
And so that's, you know, I like things like that where it's like just like, wah, wah.
Excellent.
I'm from Singapore too. I'm very happy to have seen more Singaporean writers.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, my question is, how do you continue promoting like queer voices? I mean, there are other magazines coming out, but what's your special angle like?
So this was actually something that I struggled with when I was starting the magazine, because going to science fiction conventions and talking to other writers, a lot of writers, what they want to know is, where can I sell my story that has queer content? Okay. And although there are some exceptions, most of the major science fiction magazines today are not going to refuse to publish a story because it's queer. You know, if you look at magazines like Uncanny, they've had queer content. I have read lesbian stories in Analog. You know, it's that kind of thing where that's not the main problem. But I also would occasionally get questions from readers asking, where can I just find queer short stories? And it's really unsatisfying to say, oh, well, just kind of go to Clark's World and kind of look through their stories until you find one that's queer, or go to Uncanny. Lots of them are queer, but I don't have any specific stories to mention because, you know, there's been so many published and I'm not sure what's on the main page today. So I wanted somewhere that readers could go where they're just like, I want to find queer fiction. Everything in the magazine will be some kind of queer. Because I try to go throughout the range of the queer umbrella or the long acronym that keeps lengthening and shortening depending on who you talk to.
Sure.
You know, including the letters that you usually don't hear mentioned. Right. So I've had asexual fiction and asexual poetry as well.
Excellent.
Some of my stories have had like poly elements and pansexual elements, and then, you know, characters who are either non-binary or trans, or trans and non-binary. So it's nice to have that breadth. And one of the things that's nice about having all of my stories be some variety of queer is that it also allows me to publish stories that I would balk at if I was had, you know, an issue that was mostly straight and then there was one queer story. So I've published stories that deal with more intense issues, like stories that have domestic violence in them, in which the author is dealing with that as a issue that people face. And things like that are faced by queer people in addition to straight people. But when you can only publish one queer story, do you really want it to be the domestic violence story?
True.
And the answer is no. But when you have this giant pile of queer stories and it's just one out of many, it doesn't have to stand for all queer stories. It's just one facet of the world. So that's one thing that I find helpful. I'm not sure how well that stands out, but that's what I'm going for.
I think that's really interesting, is it offers a different reason for why you would create like a very specific project like that about a specific group or what have you. Because then one of those reasons could be exactly what you're saying, like rather than having, like, we've only got one space to show this one group, now we can show the breadth of the group, all of the different ways in which life can be lived, as it were.
Yeah.
So that's actually really interesting.
Yeah.
I like it.
I like it too.
Yeah. I you know, I can always do better. This is one of those things where everyone can always do better with inclusivity and diversity. But I do think that it helps in that because I am publishing large numbers of stories that are all queer, it's easier to make sure that I have some of the intersectionality going on and have Black authors and Asian authors, et cetera, et cetera. And I can always do better, because we can always do better on that. But it does help in terms of how it's set up. Because, you know, it's nice when someone's like, okay, well, you know, you wrote your queer Vietnamese story, but it has to be the best queer story and the best Vietnamese story. Now it's just like, it just has to be a story I like, and then I can publish it. So
that's awesome. So this actually, because you brought it up a little bit earlier, and given, you know, the specificity of the kind of work you're doing here and the fact that you're doing a podcast version as a significant part of what you're doing, You'd mentioned earlier that you worked on Shimmer for 5 years as an editor, and Shimmer is primarily known for written fiction, not necessarily podcasting. Mm. Do you find that that's a big shift in terms of how you have to approach work, either as a selection process or just in general how you think about the work?
For selection, it doesn't affect me as much as I thought it would at first. So there's been one piece that I rejected, and it was just because I believe it was a poem, and this is what's funny, is I can never remember the specifics of things I reject, but I believe it was a poem, and a lot of the poetic language hinged on words that were homophones, but knowing that they were homophones was key to understanding the poem, and I was like, I couldn't think of a way that I could personally edit it to make it understandable in audio. And that was that's pretty much the only case in which I've been like, okay, well, I can't buy the story. Because if you have homophones that have to be distinguished in prose, there's a lot more ways to work around it than there is in poetry. Because poetry is so specific on the line-by-line level. But other than that, usually things that are written work out. Sometimes there's a little bit of editing to make sure that it will be understandable in audio, but that's usually very slim, very, very slim. And it might just be the nature of what people are sending me, but so far I haven't noticed a lot of changes. I mean, a good story should be a good story, whether you're reading it or having it read to you.
Okay.
So
that's true. Joyce, I'll throw it to you.
Do you have a favorite story?
Oh my gosh.
That's an evil question, Joyce.
I know.
Which of your children shall we spare? In terms of favorite stories, I can tell you one story that is coming out soon. It's in the current issue, which I'm still putting together to put out, and the episode is not out yet. But there is a story that I'm going to be published by an author named Tori Curtis that is called You Inside Me, and I love it because it is basically a trans woman who is a vampire dealing with dating apps and then dating, and there's more intense and deep and sad and hard stuff that happened in the story.
Sure.
But like in the beginning of the story, there is like, in this world, there is a vampire specific dating app for like vampires and vampire fanciers. And like as an element, I just love weird little crap like that, because we would have like, if we had actual vampires, we would have a find yourself a vampire to suck on you app.
We would.
Find yourself a donor.
A donor. So that's what I like. One of the probably most popular stories so far, and I think some of it is that it's a really good story, and many people love it, and then some of it is that it got to be episode one, and so every time people check out the podcast, they like see the story first, but Merk Rastad's story, 12 Ways to Become a Robot, or something like that. I can never remember the exact wording of the title, because I have no memory, apparently.
Sure.
But that's okay. I really enjoy that story. There's a lot of dealing with both queerness and looking at the world differently because of being somewhat neuroatypical, and it's just a really heartfelt story, and it deals with some serious issues that a lot of us deal with there, because the protagonist is pretty depressed through a lot of the story.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can connect with that, especially in the last year. So I have to ask, because we were joking about it earlier, but apparently, much like my cat occasionally makes appearances on the podcast, your dog also creates issues with the podcast.
So I have two dogs. My older dog is named Ray, and my younger dog is named Finn. Yes, they are Star Wars names. And Ray is a yellow lab who is a perfect cinnamon roll in all ways, and would be perfectly happy while I was recording to just sleep on my bed and not make any noise. Finn, however, is apparently a blackmouth cur, which I did not know, and the rescue that I adopted him from did not know that either. They thought he was a hound mix. So a blackmouth cur is basically like a Texas version of a border collie, as far as I can tell. And he is the smartest dog I've ever known, gets bored within 10 minutes, and then will yodel at me for attention. So sometimes I'll be trying to record, and he'll be being quiet for once, and then he'll wander up and sit next to my chair and just go, and then if I tell him to be quiet, he will get more intense and start knocking shit over on my desk. And then jump on me. Because he's actually only happy if he's physically on top of me.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if he gets off of me because I've been laying on the bed reading, he will get mad and then growl at, like grumble at me and yodel at me until I go back onto the bed, and then he'll like stomp on my liver a little bit, and then he'll go find something to chew on.
Oh, man.
That's adorable.
So cute.
Yeah, he's really lucky he's cute.
And he's in one of your podcasts as a fun little add-on at the end.
Yeah, I can't remember. It's either episode 47 or 48, but I stuck some of the audio he forced me to record in the end.
That's fantastic. So why don't you let us know, where you mentioned earlier that there's more stuff coming because you're putting a new issue together. So maybe mention a little bit about that, and then obviously where to find Glittership.
Okay, so I'm in the middle of putting together my... it's a double issue because I got behind. It turns out grad school takes time, surprisingly.
Yeah.
So I'm putting together a double issue, which is winter 2017 and... or autumn 2017 and winter 2018.
Okay.
And I've got all the stories together. I'm just waiting on edits on one more story, and I'll put that out. The latest four episodes have been from that issue. So you can check out AJ Fitzwater's...
AJ Fitzwater.
Yeah, AJ Fitzwater had a story out in episode 49, which was a Glittership original, and it's Granny Death and the Drag King of London, which is... basically a drag king dealing with death during the height of the AIDS crisis. And it's kind of a memorial to Freddie Mercury.
That sounds incredible.
Yeah. It kind of blends some of the stuff I like, where there's like really deep issues, but also some kind of funny bits because, I don't know, that's just how I operate. And let's face it, things are grim, so sometimes you just gotta laugh.
Sure.
True.
Yeah. And so that's one of the stories that's coming out. The Tori Curtis story I mentioned earlier is also going to be part of that issue.
Okay.
And I should be releasing that in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
It just depends on when I get home.
So for folks listening now, that could be probably somewhere around right when this drops.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, it'll probably be out. It'll definitely be out by the end of March. But I have been putting out episodes, not regularly, but... rapidly as I can to catch up, so there will probably be new episodes before this drops as well. And then in May, Glittership Year 2, which will be collecting all the stories that came out in 2017, will be released. And
awesome.
Just like Glittership Year 1, it's going to have amazing cover art by Lacaine. I've seen some of the sketches. I think that an octopus, mermaid, and a giant fish may be involved, because those are two things I really love, and am overjoyed to have those on covers, especially with her artwork. So
that's awesome. And obviously, where can they find Glittership?
And you can find Glittership online at www.glittership.com. There's also a Twitter feed at GlittershipSF.
Okay.
And then if you can... just Google Keffy, K-E-F-F-Y. You can find me. You can also just type my name into any box on your computer and I will appear. I'm really easy to find.
I can confirm this is true.
Yes.
It's shocking the first 10 times it happens, but you get used to it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Keffy, for coming on again and letting us know how things are going. And we hope you all the success for you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And on that note, I guess, awkward ending and scene. Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. I am Sean, and with me today I have soon-to-be debut novelist, Brian Camp. Hello, sir. You want to let folks know a little bit about yourself?
My name's Brian. I like long walks on the beach. No. I'm a native New Orleanian. I taught for 6 years as a high school English teacher, and this is my first novel.
Wow. Okay, so I want to get to the novel first, but you made me think of something, because I have seen a lot of people who are from New Orleans say that there's a pronunciation that's correct, but right. You did not say that pronunciation when you said it.
Right. Well, if anybody tells you to say Nolans, they're messing with you.
Oh, are they really? Yeah. Okay.
So there's a couple of different ways to say it, and actually, it locates you basically on what part of the city you're from. There are some people who say New Orleans, like they put an R in there.
Interesting.
But the thing to be important is never say New Orleans, right? It's never that.
Never New Orleans.
Right.
Okay.
Louis Armstrong gets away with it to keep the meter going, but for anybody else, it's not New
He's
Orleans.
The only one. Huh?
It's New Orleans. That's it.
New Orleans. Okay. Perfect. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about your book, but before we get there, I want to kind of talk about the path you took to get to the book being a thing that's going to actually happen now.
Sure.
Because you are a graduate from University of New Orleans.
Right.
From the MFA program. You also went to Clarion West.
2012.
And so I'm curious, like, what got you to the point of I'm now actually going to take this writing thing seriously and, you know, try for things like an MFA or, you know, Clarion?
Well, so the easy answer for those two specific things is my wife. Everything good or positive I've ever accomplished in my life is basically because I said I wanted to do something. And then immediately said that I wouldn't be able to do it or wouldn't be able to get into it or whatever. And she sat me down and put the application in front of me and said, do this thing. So MFA program, Clarion West, both of those, I wouldn't have even applied for either one of them, if she hadn't told me, shut up, stupid, and do this, right? Which, you know, is a good thing to have in a partner. But for this particular book and kind of the journey, that got there, I was in an undergraduate fiction class taught by Bev Marshall at Southeastern, where I got my undergrad degree. The weekend before Katrina hit, and we had an assignment that we had to turn in, and a lot of people don't realize what the mindset was like for people in the Gulf South when Katrina was coming, but. For the most part, hurricanes come and do what they do and they go. And
right.
And you come back, and that's the way it works. So if you have the means and the privilege to pack up and leave, you know, you pack for like a weekend and you go and then you come back. And so I had this assignment that for all I knew I would have to turn in the following week. So I brought my homework with me when we evacuated, which, you know, in hindsight, it sounds completely ridiculous, but in the moment, it made perfect sense.
Sure.
So in the backseat of my parents' car, as we were evacuating, I started writing what became this book. I finished a draft of it after I graduated, got into the MFA program, learned a lot and worked on short fiction and a lot of that kind of stuff. So for my thesis as a master's program, I rewrote the book. And then I got... you know, sent it out to agents, that sort of stuff. Didn't get a whole lot of traction. Then got into the Clarion West program. Learned a whole lot about what I'm trying to do. And then after Clarion West, I rewrote it again. And
it's a
lot of rewrites. 11 years basically from idea to completion. Once I signed with my agent, Seth Fishman, I was prepared for another long haul of revisions and rewrites and that sort of thing. And once I actually had rewritten the book a fourth time for Seth, once we actually signed, you know, we changed the name and then we were on submission and then sold it in a week. So
wow,
it took 11 years to get to a point where, you know, anything happened with it and then sold it in a week, which is not, it's not the way that's supposed to work, but
no, but it did. So this, before we get into the big question that you kind of brought up, which is, you know, your own experiences being from there and everything. But I want to talk a little bit about the books. You want to tell folks a little bit about what this book is about?
Sure. It's a murder mystery. It's set in it's 6 years after Katrina. And the version of New Orleans that I'm writing about is one in which the gods of various world mythologies all kind of coexist behind the scenes. And the main character is a demigod.
Okay.
But he doesn't know which god was his father. And so he has the magical talent of finding lost things, which becomes very difficult to handle after the storm. And so he gets pulled back into that world kind of and has to go to a poker game. And he walks into this poker game with Toth from Egyptian myth, Legba from voodoo, a vampire, an angel, and the fortune god of New Orleans. And right after the game, the fortune god of New Orleans gets murdered, and he's got to figure out who did it and what it means for the city and all that.
So this I'm going to go out on a limb. There's an obvious connection with the title, which is the City of Lost Fortunes.
Correct, right.
Which I'm sure gets unpacked in a very interesting way in the book.
Hopefully.
Well, yeah. I think it took a week for them to pick it up. I think someone thought it was interesting. So I know, like, you kind of mentioned, right, that, you know, the kind of experience of, you know, I'm picking up my stuff and I'm going to
right.
go, you know, evacuate this situation. I mean, I have a little, not the same experience, I want to make that very clear, but we recently had a huge hurricane go right up the spine of Florida, and by the time it got up to us, thankfully it wasn't as dangerous. But it was one of those things where there's like a very tenuous, like, what is happening?
Mm-hmm.
In your case, your tenuousness was, you know, you evacuated, so you knew at least you would be safe, but you didn't know what you were going to go back to.
Right.
And so I guess, like, you know, that obviously had a huge impact on what led you to writing this book, that it was sort of a visceral experience.
Yeah. So, you know, I can't talk about this as it was anyway a hardship. You know, like we were perfectly safe, we were perfectly fine, and there's all kinds of loss that we didn't experience.
Sure.
But there was you also have to remember that this is pre a lot of social media, and pre rapid access to cell phones and text messaging and that sort of thing. There was all of the obvious devastation and loss and difficulty that's been well documented and written about, and that's not in any way what's going on in the story. This is set 6 years after.
Right.
But from my own experience, I sat on a sofa in my aunt's house in Florida, and for all I knew, everything that I didn't bring with me was gone. You know, we lived at the time in Slidell, a city, a suburb town just north of, well, it's not really north, but on the north shore of New Orleans. And so you might have remembered the helicopter shots of the bridge, that sections of the bridge had been torn apart from, right? You know, that camera would go basically right to showing what had happened in Slidell, and then just cut out, and so we didn't know what it was like. And then they had these message boards set up, you know, just to kind of say, like, you know, I saw this happen and I saw this happen, and it got hugely aggrandized. And I thought the place that I worked burned down. I thought I didn't know what kind of school I was going to be able to go back to, what kind of job I could. The New Orleans that I had in my head, and I talk about this a little bit in the author's note, the New Orleans that I had in my head that I was going to write about, literally at the beginning of this book, wasn't there anymore. And so it took a long time, and there's a reason that it's 6 years later, is because I had to learn about the new New Orleans to learn what city I was writing about now. So
that's I don't even understand, like. It's a weird thing, you know, to try to understand it from the outside as somebody who's never experienced that worry of what I'm going back to. Because my town, we got hit, you know, and trees went down, some people lost power for a while, and places got flooded a bit, and some people lost a lot of stuff. But it wasn't that widespread devastation. And so there was a sense of, like, you know, in a week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe three, we're all going to go back to normal. I mean, it's going to be fine. But, you know, if you went down south, you know, like the Keys, like, you can imagine people who'd fled to Georgia in exactly the same position of what is to come.
Right.
And I guess it's a terrifying prospect to have to sit there and not know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
the only word I can think of is apocalyptic, you know, because one thing that I have to remind people about is that it wasn't just New Orleans. It was the whole
coastline,
you know, it was a huge portion of the Gulf South. Just a few days after the storm, me and my dad and my uncle, another uncle of mine, they were a nurse in Covington, and we were bringing water and supplies and seeing, you know, what was left of our home and that sort of thing. And I mean, we were driving along the interstate. There were parts of the interstate we couldn't drive on anymore. There were boats, and I don't mean like rowboats with a little trolling motor. I mean,
like big old boats
in the trees, you know. And it was
apocalyptic is right. That word you could use for that. Yeah. Okay, so I want to maybe go to a slightly different, happier side.
Yeah.
It's just something that I felt some degree of connection having actually had my first real hurricane for once, and so it was just sort of an experience that I don't think people get to share in any way.
Right.
So, for me, it's still a little bit weird to kind of watch a hurricane come up and like, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. So, one of the things that is interesting about this book is there's something about the city of New Orleans that I don't know what it is, but, you know, you've brought in the idea that the, you know, the gods of old all kind of like coalesced in this place working behind the scenes. But that seems like such a thing that, like, if gods really existed, would be a New Orleans thing.
Right.
And I guess as somebody who lives there, what is it that you think makes this city seem like it's a place of magic?
Right. So there's really two answers to that question. One is that New Orleans has, from pretty much its inception, been a port, you know? And so there's a huge influx of cultures and things coming in and going out, and so it's just a constantly moving, and so that brings a whole lot of people into one place. And once you get a bunch of cultures together, you know, that's a place where stuff happens.
Sure.
And especially the kind of myth that I'm talking about in this book, I'm looking at syncretic myth, which is the idea that when cultures come together, sometimes peacefully, sometimes oppressively, their myths kind of squeeze together. When, you know, they aren't completely obliterated.
Right.
And so, you know, voodoo, for instance, when Africans were enslaved and forced into servitude here, they weren't just allowed to do whatever they wanted. They were told, okay, you're Catholic now. And this is who you worship, and these are the saints, and so on. And this is a hugely simplistic explanation, but, you know, they were, you know, they looked at St. Peter, for instance, and they said, well, what does this saint do? And, you know, he opens the gates to the afterlife, the gates to heaven, right? And they said, well, that sounds a lot like Legba. That's the guy who stands at the crossroads and opens the gates into the underworld. And they were like, so sure, we'll worship St. Peter, but really we're just talking about Papa Legba. So there's examples of that all over, you know, flood myths and vampires and skin changers and terianthropic is actually the term for changing into animals and that sort of thing. You know, there's all kinds of connections. I took that idea of kind of like a port city where there are all of these things coming together and churning, and, you know, some things get lost and some things get squeezed together and some things kind of become, you know, one thing. So all of that's going on a little bit in the book. The other answer to the why New Orleans, other than the write what you know truism, you know, New Orleans itself is kind of a myth. Even among the people who live there, if you think of myth as kind of the stories that we tell each other to try to understand what's going on in the world, the idea that I have of New Orleans is different, A, probably from reality, and B, from any other New Orleanian. And so there's this kind of collective idea of what New Orleans is. And for some people, that's a good thing, and for some people, it's bad. But there's a collective idea that, you know, if you tell some, if there's the famous Tennessee Williams line of there are three American cities, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. Everywhere else is Cleveland, you know, which is no offense to anybody in Cleveland. Tennessee Williams said that, not me. But that's the, you know, the kind of collective idea that there is this mythic place. And that goes all the way back to, you know, if you look at historical records and things like that, they were talking about New Orleans as a place of sin and debauchery, like, from the very beginning. Yep. So
that's fascinating. So this explains so much about, like, really the impetus behind this book, about the setting, not just write what you know, but there's something special about New Orleans. It's a weird place that I've never been to.
You should come.
I need to come. I drove past it, and we had a big old truck that didn't have AC, and it was breaking all the time. So, yeah. So it's complicated. But anyway, so the book comes out April 17th.
Correct.
Of this year, 2018.
Mm-hmm.
It'll come out from John Joseph Adams.
HMH, John Joseph Adams. Yep.
So that'll be out. It'll be pretty much available in any format imaginable, except maybe like Smoke Signal.
Right.
That one might be difficult.
But support your independent local bookstores.
Yes, please
do.
That's always my thing.
That's
always your thing? Right. Perfect. So I guess the big question other than that is, where can folks find you? And do you have anything else that they might want to look forward to in the next year?
Well, I just had a short story come out in Lightspeed last month. The Independence Patch is about a kid who... gets computer parts put in his brain, like, basically at conception. And he, like, grows up with computer parts in his brain. So if that sounds interesting to you, it's at Lightspeed. I have a website, briancamp.com, and I'm on Twitter at briancamp.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Brian, for coming on and talking to me.
Thanks. It's been great.
Awkward ending and scene. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.